Welcome to the So-and-So series, readings by early career poets. So, yeah, in addition to the reading, the live performance, and the broadsides, most, if not all, of the So-and-So readings are on a podcast. This one will be no different, hopefully, if all works out. I think that's it. I'm going to shut up now. We're just going to go in alphabetical order. Our first reader is Lily Brown. She was born and raised here in Massachusetts and currently lives in San Francisco. She is the author of the chapbook, The Renaissance Sheet, published by Octopus Books out in Nebraska in 2007. And her second chapbook, Old With You, is forthcoming from Kitchen Press, which is located in Hell's Kitchen, New York City, in 2008. Her poems have appeared or will appear in Typo, Octopus, Handsome, Coconut Fence, Pleiades, and 26. Round of applause for Lily Brown.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Chris. And thank you for the broadside to the people who made it. It's beautiful. I've been coveting from afar for a while, so I'm so excited about that, and I also want to thank my family and family friends for coming, especially my grandmother. Can you hear me, Bobby? Okay. I just wanted to make sure. Okay. We were just having a conversation at dinner about the difference between the Atlantic and Pacific coastlines and how much the Pacific coastline feels. So the first poem I'm reading actually, I think, relates to that a little bit at the end. It's called Backpedaling for Statements. She says the book can't feel the smart of tumble and hit. But here in the office, window cases mini landscape, my brown rulers run through and across the grass. Now a world, impression of ground cover and tree with sunlight. She says the book can't feel, but I'm inside. The book has many minds. She wants to know the climate of the room where I last wrote. Was it the living room? Was it the staircase, the memory of a I make a lie of the absolute, space like a boring reflection that never changes. And it's space she's after, space where she has me build statements out of ignorance. Here are the words. Here is a length, a pause, a glance out the window for effect. Here is the way I heard toads in the woods without paths in the woods, saw a golden golf course through the woods, and sneaking to the greens found everything was wrong. Fake fountains in the watery parts. Oh God, in the restaurant, we overhang the ocean, overhand the ocean, underlie erosion. There's music in the dining room and people at the motor in the lot. China clucks the table, and what's it made of? Milk? Because it holds milk? For felines? For children? Because it's white? Did you see that dog? That dog? That dog head out the window? Oh God, you've confirmed the voices, the moonlight through the boulders off the coast. Strange paths cut through. Last night, the moon so ruddy we couldn't confirm it. The sayings we know, the warnings we've heard about moons and sailors. To a tree. Eucalyptus is the object. It means project. Bathe in its leaves. Sob its autumn. Defend its non-nativity. Take on the tree and fist fight desire. Shadows lie. I see them, features, limbs, ink with shifty edges. Break it atypically, the day to pieces, each differently visible. Shade open so the street is lined. Sitting tree is salty with dusk. Early sun distributes risk. Its lineage casts shadows. Shadows that pull a tree down. Broken, legible heap. And this is the poem that's on the broadside. It's maybe the shortest poem I've ever written, but I love. I name. I name something, something, to understand. A temporary peace, thought, images, repeat. I skim for feeling, no literal intent. X on it. All my life I saw new freckles, brown moons, I don't know, pinions, skin, arms hung on the train strut. Animal, animal in the tree's beam, I see you standing in your cradle. I recently took sort of a 4-month hiatus from writing, which was not happened, and I just started writing a little bit again, so I'm really excited to have new things to read, and this is one of them. It's called Museum Armor. A fish-tailed woman mounted my wall, gave me a feeling. I thought of nuns. The clock flashed on the ceiling. Time was inside. You under the owl white sky. I scratched the glass with my eye. Tipped birds over the red bridge. The sun in my wall. We slant. Speech centers our backs. The matter. Night dims. Low fire inks are written by the pamphlet we read. I see you beside, a blind on the night. On the cold side, tree seeds beat cut wood. You walk from structure, your outline on the door, the matter of you moving. Sitting in the car, swallows fall from wire, silver tributes to the sun. Who comes here? Deer-faced cows in the open range. The blackbird tucks her wings. Swallows all from wire. We pass. Sideways, we are bodies. One dimension, being moved. And this is a longer poem. It's in 4 parts. It's called The Phosphorescent Dark. 1. Fascinated, I stay in for days. Riding cars straight through stop signs, riding cars past speed signs that blaze white, headlight shining back, penalty. This is about the busing lost in the couch, all the genies that fill the phosphorescent dark. 2. Where is the sandman hiding the dirt? 3. I have 3 lives in 3 closets. To build light in them, you stand up inside. Of the first, admiring my sills. I struck the mirror, pounded in the door, and had a vision. Name, stomach, and a voice. And in the tiny space that made their middle, that made a middle, I was the slackest place. 4. From the book, I have a vision of the future, early in a vision of the future. In that place, the mind went. It gave itself away. Continuing with the theme of books. This one is called Tropicalia. I lost the book. Could we find the book? Together again, outside the patch of Tropicalia. Emerged together, January 2nd, unsullied. I'm touching walls. It means something, my furtive relationship to birds. I saw you on a field of mud, and the mud was important. Derived from a shady hall. Prior to memorization, I had squares of light, position of body on back. In bed, buffets out the window. Tell them I'll come for them. Tell them we saw them in our dreams. Fed them carrots and white clover, and they liked it. That my teeth are talking, that teeth of light kept me up late summer nights. Information in the dark, dendrites in the body, and dendrites in minerals look proof that one night bends the mouth, day the eye. On the long, tanned path, we write without hands, greenery and imagery bending in all directions, away from the sun. This enlarges the spine. I know the spine. I know I'm not the spine. From left to right. Lift up and enter the body from above. Be the window that lowers to wall in houses on bays where glasses are ships. Sink by sleight of water and not by wreck. Conversations cobbled from complaint. I am a case complete. The difference between people and drakes is we paint ourselves. Waves are greyhounds that outshoulder one another. The seal's not stopped. Surface breaching is more than we manage. I found the secret. Don't tell him what he sees. We can't alien eyes. There's one question. The name will give it an apparition. The seal's whiskers sent something above and to the side. When I say we, I don't mean we're the same. I mean we fall on each other. This is the last poem I'm going to read of my mother, so I think you know what it is. Old with you. I wait for my wrist lines. If I push them, boxes make themselves. I shorten your name to a letter to make you new. Time spreads. These materials populate my life. I turn on the weather. The weather ashes the books. The house can live underwater. The house can wear its rooms out. So what if the house? The primitive is a process more real, more hated. Real book, the thoughts in you are secondhand. Thanks.
Thank you, Lily. Our second reader is Betsy Wheeler, originally from the Upper Mississippi River Valley. She studied poetry and the art of the book at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, fellow for Sutton Hoo Press. She received her MFA in poetry from The Ohio State University in 2005, then lived, worked, and wrote as the Stadler Fellow at Bucknell University's Stadler Center for Poetry from 2005 to 2007. Her poems have recently appeared in The Journal, Bat City Review, Mi Poesias, Pebble Lake Review, Forklift Ohio, and Absent. Her chapbook, Start Here, is available from Small Anchor Press. Co-editor of Pilot and Pilot Books, she lives in Northampton, Massachusetts, where she works for Wondertime magazine. Betsy Wheeler.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me. This is such a beautiful place. I can't even believe it. And it's a real honor and a pleasure to be here and meeting with Lily and with Mark, too. And the beautiful broadside from Ropadote. So thanks for having me. I'm going to read first the poem from the broadside and then read some older poems, some newer poems. Non-sonnet for innumerable suns. Can you all hear me? Fantastic. Sometimes in summer heat, it's just good to lie here. Lie in bed. When I do, I think sometimes of you, stirring your third cup of coffee with a little spoon. I want to pick up everyone I love from and place them in the cities that I know. In a movie we saw once, a man lay dying in his bed, his right hand resting over his heart, I solemnly swear. He tapped his chest with his index finger twice. Was it reassurance or impatience? I don't know. Tap your chest now, old lover. Assure me of nothing. Innumerable suns have and us. I'm not coming back this time. No matter for your hands. I have all sorts of hope. For instance, your lips. Is bee stung a cliche? It might be plenty to say so red. Compliments, that is to say, giving or receiving. I hope that won't end poorly, this drive we've taken in your parents' car. Probably I'll keep quiet, recording the sun and the leaves and the hills and the sun and my hand out the window, reckless, restless. How old are we? That wasn't animosity. I love your lips. Once we had a dream, and in it were banisters floating, people leaning. The beautiful leaning of dreams came with us to the edge of this bluff, where we fed water to the sparrows in gorgeous silver ladles, also lemon pie. Do you remember it the same way I do? Funny what we remember of what we invent in sleeping, especially together. So, about your lips, it was Sunday and the sea was so green. Feels so quiet in here. I can like hear every single crinkle of the paper. Love letter written over water. Dear unknown sailor, beside the white dawning of our correspondence, I wish to sit and watch with wonder the sky unfold. By my little cat Sancho, I've taken to sitting at the red dock's edge, my green parasol's pole lodged in a knot hole. Beneath the dock's wooden slats, we hear the muskies growl, trolling their long silver bodies through the lake weeds. Sancho doesn't scare. I imagine the fish's rows of sharp white teeth are what is clinking the metal dock poles, a sound like hollow piano keys or bone. Tonight, the loons will lilt their love calls across the lake, but now, my god or sailboat captain, the music is machine-like. Those are those plucky white jet skis. Various and skyfall. Something for the low end. When I was in high school and junior high, I was in the choir, which now terrible singing voice, but I guess it doesn't matter when you're in junior high. But I was an alto, and for some reason the altos always got the shaft. Like the altos were just like not the ones who got the fun solos or all the attention. It was all about the sopranos. No offense to any sopranos in the audience, of course. So this is for the alto section. You angel me, or I turn in my wings and fall. You are the afternoon curled up in. You work boot the dangling measures. You speak in money, and money goes south. You backbone the tenors. You give me stead. If you were naked, you'd be drawn by a steady hand. If you cared a whit about callback, you'd saunter in late. I worry, my worries wallow in. You tallish French harlot, I have no knowledge. Your parlor is piles of poison pillows. Your blue teardrops pool on my ledges. Your shades are so rodeo. You are the philosophy jacks often. You'd forgive half of Chelsea, a training wheel to the virgin evenings, begging. You're so dark-washed. You look better in cranberry. You should take off your sweater. Take your hands out your pockets. Life doesn't have to be this way. It could be handsomer. It could make the sound of crystal beads jumping. It wants to be accordion music on your birthday morning. Never mind what was muted. It's sort of mysterious. It's incredibly transparent. Of all public blunders and subsequent embarrassment, it's already home in bed by now. Poor thing. Non-sonnet for the you behind the bedroom door. Dear reader, when I say I mean to ravage, I'm generally talking to ice cubes. When pleading in a scaly voice, I say, of you, I mean I'm afraid you will leave me with my muffler of sea green foam, my star-shaped sunglasses. When I tell you that I love my neighbor, I actually mean my next door neighbor. How his crying makes the trees bow over the house, makes the grass try to stand up straighter. When, signed off and halfway sleeping, I murmur, oh, fabulous coverlet, it means I feel ready for death's call. When I say again, I'll be sorry when this ends, and my voice is shards of ice, then I'm not addressing my drink, but rather the whole mad collection of you. Non-sonnet for a night snail. Only in the 14th quadrant of a kaleidoscope, Captain's Rabbit, may the vanquished places of our wanting float without shyness. Around the sea captain's heart flows a moat that's built for gazing. Come gazing. Come graze on the memories of strangers, or gaze at burly knuckles while you feel your places in need of kneading. Desperate sailors on the brink of marrying brine will dance bolero names, risk eye teeth, do anything to preserve the memory of solid ground. Or nothing. Everything is what we want. And so Mars becomes an issue. I'm gazing at it now, counting its earnest pockets, burying its brutal red. I just realized right now I have lots of pockets in my poem. That's weird. Mm-hmm. Pockets too? I don't know. There's a lot of symbolism going on here. So these next poems are from this new project that I've been working on that I call the Hysterical Markers. And it's just because I stole a whole bunch of text from old historical markers, like roadside historical markers, from the side roads in Pennsylvania where I once lived. So all of that said, none of these poems really have anything to do with the actual historical events that were printed on the markers, but it was a generative process. So this one was after a roadside marker about Christopher Sholes, who was the inventor of the typewriter. Which seems fine, write a poem about the inventor of a typewriter if you're a writer, right? I mean, who knows what's going to happen when you try it, but you at least got to try. The unauthorized biography of Christopher Sholes. The inventor of the typewriter was not by trade an inventor. A mewing pack of kittens born in his family's barn, also a duck, but in the pond. A baby in the room painted his head a small idea about salmon. Near to there, a series of explosions, chrysanthemums blooming low in clear skies over Baltimore. The memory of February was to him 14 snowballs stored in the icebox. He could have been 18 or 19, a dead ringer for Horace. He went to bed early, thinking of G sitting next to H, Butte's holds to butter. School and work are sisters, he thought. He'd wanted out of the family. As a painter, he was mindful but redundant. Supper at the library was only allowed in summertime. Librarian Dan is a shusher from Shushville, he pouted. Migration, though not usually used to describe human travel, appealed to him as a method. A short report on Wisconsin told to him for the first time the food name pasty, wrapped handily in napkins, then placed in squeaking lunch pails. His personality was often borderline collie. First came the faint rustling of horsemen from under the bedclothes. They probably were hollering, "Riding machinery," but what he heard was, "Riding to Tuileries," and this would set him back in years. His way of saying his thin fingers should have been patented. That was a very serious idea. The inflatable jackets were issued to all the riders on the ferry, but he was in the loo. It was June 23rd, 1868, and he was very far from home. It's poetry, right? It can be fiction. Buffalo Church. By and by, the sound of women singing presses its gentle knees to my ears. By the river, they wanted to lead me. Past the groundswell, little homes stuffed into hillsides. The silence between high notes was scary, scary. The air terrarium still, or stuck like jellyfish poison, slowly sewing its way through the ocean's deep breezes. Pioneers no doubt would have fled. But look at us standing here, remembering 1773 as a year of great darkness. The foreman all broken up about something or other, his hands steamy and sad, brushing away brown rivulets of sweat. Flung into thirst, we ride through past and present all at once. Church me, you say. Church me the hell out of here, and I place my heart with stone, and I will. I will fling me, church you, toward that light stands a mile to the north. I'm just going to read two more poems, and thank you for listening and being here and having me. Robbed and swung low into reverie. And so the wind, humid but welcome, comes a body against our houses, attaching everyone to everyone else. Nobody is famed for anything, not the hymn writers or sous chefs, not the marathoners, all just living or have lived in the particular house of the body. One body is similar in silhouette to eight other bodies, is opposite in skin texture to six. One body will fit perfect others, will violently reject seven, and is momentarily indistinguishable from five. Here's where things get tricky. Some of these bodies will find each other on scooters in the streets of Rome, or weeding in the public gardens of Minneapolis, maybe trespassing the high dunes of North Carolina's coastline. The best-known meetings will become the stuff of hymns, the catalyst for wars. Were it up to me, I would have written one of the odds much higher. Guess which one? I'd like to say our young bodies fit perfectly, but it's more accurate to say our limbs locked like softly notched gears, our engines wheeling. I was stunned. I mean stung. I mean our skin sung in river. We looked impossible, effortless, a low tide. Love circuitry unmapped but gently numbered. He was of the 8, or maybe the 9. Oh, I believe in believing in the 9s. And one last one. What's been said about wormholes? I got, again, stealing text. I guess I do that a lot. From a fake personal ad where someone was asking for someone to, like, time travel with them in, back in time. And, like, the guy had, like, this mullet, and he looked crazy. I was like, all right, that's, you know, really? You know how to do that? What's been said about wormholes? Ding. Asking the genius saints of my sleep to bring me a traveling companion with loaded eyes. This sounds like a joke, but believing it is funnier, and yesterday was better. Let's go there. What's already happened, your midnight dancing, sore elbows, the wind whipping her long hair like cattails, all become the breadcrumbs for the long trip back. Something this good and ability should be called gleaming. When we step out onto the dark road, its tubular wake, onlookers will call the noise we make static. I will call it loud dreaming in a quiet room. Thank you.
Thank you, Betsy. Our final reader is Mark Jakic. His new poetry collection is The Importance of Peeling Potatoes in Ukraine, Penguin 2008. I had to look that up to see if that was a typo. It's like, is there a the? But it's just Peeling Potatoes in Ukraine. Penguin. That's out on Penguin this year. He lives in New Orleans. His web.com. Mark Jakic.
Thanks, Chris. It's a very small podium. You can't really put your keys and things on there. Thanks for having me. Thanks for the broadside, which is great, and for the hard work perforating Gawile and Chris for curating and Lily, who I just met, and Betsy. I kind of met her through I don't know, various circumstances, but that the non-sonnet for the U behind the door.
Yeah.
We published that one, Pindeli Boz, didn't
yeah.
we? Yeah. This is a little magazine in New York called Pindeli Boz, which no one's ever heard of. We did all poetry issue, and Betsy had a poem in there. And I published. It was really, I like all the non-sonnets. What's the deal with the non-sonnets, by the way? Why are they called non-sonnets? I mean, I'm curious because people, I'm sure, are curious. Non-sonnet.
It's basically a way of playing with the form. Like, actually, I had a real obsession with the sonnet form as a way of building argument in a poem. And so I was using that, but then completely letting go of the metrical form.
What about the
Unless
turn?
I felt like it.
What about the turn?
Yeah, there's always a turn.
See,
you have a turn.
You like the turn, though, and the non-sonnets are still turns?
Yes.
See? That's can't get rid of the turn.
You know? Semi-sonnet.
Well, I have a prose sonnet I'll read in a little bit. But yeah, the sonnet's one of those things that I think you can play with a lot easier than the Sistina. You don't see people, like, fucking with the Sistina, you know?
Right.
People should fucking leave the Sistina alone.
Hands off the Villanelle. I mean, like, you keep trying to write about it. One Art is, like, the best Villanelle that'll ever be written, you know, by Elizabeth Bishop. And if you don't know that poem, One Art, by Bishop, you should just get it.
What's The Waking by
It's all right. Metzke, it's all right.
Yeah, but it's not.
It's a Villanelle, but
yeah.
It's all right. But One Art is
better.
Yeah. The art of losing is hard to master. Anyone know it by heart, One Art? You know it by heart?
Say it.
No, I don't think I can
remember. Oh, come on, give me the first couple lines. Yeah, And then she goes, like, she loses, like, keys.
Yeah.
And then what? Yeah, house, and then a whole country. And you can't think, you think it can't build up higher than a country. How can you lose more than your country? You know? How can you lose more than that? And then at a certain point, what does she lose? I mean, how do you lose more than a country in the poem? Yeah, she was the person, right? I guess that's bigger than
the country. She lived in Brazil, I guess.
In the poem, you know, you lose a person. But she's got this whole doubleness about writing then, too, in the poem. It's just, it's great. Don't you think it's really good, Bill and Elle?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. You memorized it, right? So, I'll read a few poems from the first couple books just because they're a lot different than the new book. They have all these long, obnoxious titles. In a group waiting to cross, and I stole that title. I used to have a one-word title when I had it as a manuscript. It's a one-word title that I can't tell you what it was. It was so bad. But I was looking for titles. You know, you have your manuscript of poems, and you don't know what you're gonna. You know, what am I gonna title this? It's important, the title of your book, and what it's gonna look like, and the cover image. You know, maybe for poetry, you know, no, you still care about it, right? I still have to tell your mother and your grandmother. Right, Grandma? I mean, you have to tell her what your title of your book is going to be. And so you want it to be something kind of memorable. And anyway, I stole this from a caption underneath a photograph. And the caption was of a bunch of people first, the book was called and it was a collaboration between a psychiatrist and the poet Weldon Keyes. Does anyone know the poet Weldon Keyes?
Sure.
Yeah, he has this great sonnet called For My Daughter, right? Where at the end he says, I have no daughter, or I don't want one. I have no daughter, I don't want one, or whatever the hell. He doesn't want a daughter at the end of his sonnet, even though he has one. It's really dark. But Wendell Keyes was a crazy kind of character of the 50s, 40s, 50s, a jazz pianist. He wrote poems. He collaborated on books about nonverbal communication that were published by Berkeley, you know, University of Berkeley, California Berkeley, whatever. And he also took photographs. So he took all these photographs. So he took the photograph and he wrote the captions for all these photos. And the photos of a bunch of people waiting for a stoplight to change, corner, like huddled up cold. And the caption was, unrelated individuals forming a group waiting to cross. And I wrote that down. I just liked it as a phrase. And I tucked it away in some scrap of paper. And then I forgot about it. And then years later, I was looking for a title. And I just was going through scraps of paper and I found it. And it fit for the book because the book's filled up with like messed up superheroes, like messed up this archetypal fairy. There's a blind girl, and there's a man with 64 lovers, and there's the invisible man's daughter, and there's the teller, like the teller behind the tale. There's a poem called "The Teller is the Only Survivor of the Fairy Tale Ending." There's other people, right? And the book comes out, and my brother-in-law said, "Hey, you know, I like." He took poetry class in college, and he read poems. So he read the book. He's like, I like it. But who's this? Who are some of these characters? I mean, so who's the Invisible Man's daughter? And I said, what do you mean, who's the Invisible Man's daughter? He said, well, is that your sister? You know, my wife, because my dad's really introverted and really quiet, and so he's there at dinner, you know, and so, you know, his daughter, the Invisible Man's daughter. I said, no. And he's like, oh, so it's your girlfriend. The girlfriend at the time was like really estranged from her father, right? So he's an invisible man, and that's the invisible man's daughter. And I said, well, I never thought, no. It's kind of interesting. But he kept trying to figure out who the real people were and the real story behind the poem. And there wasn't. I made these things up, you know. There's a blind girl. I made up the blind girl. I'm not blind, you know. I don't know. Sometimes, you know, you wish you're blind for a little while, but not very long, and so I wrote this poem, but he kept trying to guess, but it got me thinking about, well, who are these people, you know, and so I started writing these prose poems that told the story behind, this is a little chapbook, it's about 20 of the poems in the first book that have the same title as poems in this book, and they tell the story, so I'll just read a couple little poems from these, and I'll go to the new work. So here's a poem called Prose Sonnet. Prose sonnet. Eyes take apart the clouds as if unbuttoning his shirt. On the way to your house, he will bend down, tie his shoes like framing a picture. He will clip flowers with his teeth from the neighbor's garden. He will discard them before reaching your house. He will descend the hill, pretending not to be watched as you watch him from the smallest attic window. But you will not see him round the final curve. Before letting him in, you will forget to ask him to replace the pebbles he's kept in his hip pocket with the heavy rock near the mailbox. Because you're already in love, sit down, you will say, pointing to the chair. No, don't kiss me. It won't be necessary. Prose sonnet. The shirt in the poem is real. The house was not. And the last line was stolen from a philosopher who was in love with a 13-year-old boy. The attic window from which the reader views all this alleged failing in love was pentagonal, red and yellow stained glass. Over the years, many neighborhood kids have tried to knock out the window, but it can only be smashed from the inside out. Need my little cheat sheet. This is a poem called Reluctant Prophet. We all know what reluctant prophets are, right?
No.
Who can help out Chris? What's a reluctant name of a reluctant prophet?
Jonah.
Who said that? Who said that? Jonah? Did you read this?
No. Is he a plant?
Jonah?
No.
Is it the whale guy?
No.
Not Melville, the other Jonah. Yeah, I didn't know that either. I Googled. It's called Reluctant Prophet, right? Reluctant Prophet. And for example, I, Jonah, am large in my way. Little by little, tooth by tooth, the body swells. Bits fit in, the sound of herringbone teeth. The pieces unfold, neat and distinct. The end circuit leaves a handful of shit. This inky body, my body of work. A shadow when two things touch. We cut into the sea, the sky an echo of ice, the beast cuts into me, my voice a toy crow, a ripple, a thigh, the whole fleshy fever, sexton. Reluctant Prophet. I knew a man who laughed to himself more than ever at the dinner table. He had been in remission from something I still don't know how to pronounce correctly, and I wondered if being in remission didn't have something to do with his laughing. His eyes were deep brown, very unlike pools or cat's eyes, and his eyelashes were toothed across the table. And he didn't look ill. Once I asked him what was so funny. He seemed confused and a little embarrassed, and I never asked him again. Because I first met him a long time ago, I don't remember it very well. It was the beginning of a tepid, uneventful summer. He had just finished working on the guidance system for the Apollo that went to the moon. Years later, he was the first person to show me how a plane is able to take off. I felt too young to know about fighter jets and satellites subtly. But I kept this feeling secret. He kept the voices in his head a secret from my sister and me. Once his father had been an alcoholic, but now his father was dead, so that secret didn't mean much to anyone anymore. His mother was still alive. She had raised 10 children. Only one of them had committed suicide, and only one of them had died by accidentally mixing chlorine with ammonia to scrub the kitchen floor. All the other brothers and sisters were alive, and most of them worked at Caterpillar making earth-moving equipment. One of the brothers owned a roofing company and a Baskin-Robbins. He used to give me ice cream coupons for my birthday, which would infuriate me if I hadn't spent any real money. It was an old house and an old dining room table, since he and his wife, my mother, never threw anything out. So, the second book, everyone thinks I made up stuff in the second book, you know, made up stories, but I started thinking about, you know, who the Invisible Man's daughter was and who the Rust the Prophet was and things, and I started thinking, well, the Invisible Man's daughter, that's not Ralph Ellison's daughter. That's this girl I had a crush on from third grade until eighth grade, but I never even held her hand, you know? And the Reluctant Prophet was actually my father, you know? And so I started putting real names. There's like real names in this book, like Stephanie Gottschalk. She may be here. Dory Lindgren. who had Hodgkin's disease and died at 21. And there's no real names in the first book, but everyone thinks I made up these things, but there's more like truth in that book. It's funny, you know, what you can do with poems. Betsy was kind of saying that, you know. Fiction writers aren't really good fiction writers. They're not really good liars. Poets are better liars. It's just true. Because fiction writers have to compete with... Well, that's a good question, Chris, but I can't answer it. You have to answer for yourselves, right? Right? But a poet, you don't expect fiction, or you don't expect nonfiction necessarily from a poet. You expect just, I don't know, something else. So those first two books came out, and then I didn't expect to write this next book, but I just kind of had. It's got real people in it, too, but... In a different way, I suppose. The first poem I'm going to read is about patriotism. It's called A Brief History of Patriotism. Everyone knows what that is, right? I mean, patriot. A Brief History of Patriotism. 5000 BCE. Is around this time that the potato was first cultivated by the ancient peoples of the Andes. 476 to 1000 CE. At some point during the Dark Ages, it is believed that a band of potatoes makes its way across the Bering Strait, but this remains 1100 to 1500. The Incas grow, eat, and worship the potato, and often bury it with their dead. 1536. The first European to see a potato, the Spanish conquistador Pedro de Cies de Leon, he promptly conquers it. 1565. Another Spanish conquistador, Padre de las Patatas, takes the potatoes back to Spain in lieu of the gold he did not find. 1589. The Italians discover that potatoes are part of the nightshade family, related to tobacco and tomatoes. In this same year, a Florentine noblewoman discovers gnocchi between her legs one morning. 1604. Came for him, did you? 1604. Shakespeare invents mashed potatoes, potato pancakes, twice baked potatoes, thrice baked potatoes, and very burnt potatoes. 1605. In France, the potato is outlawed for fear that it causes leprosy, syphilis, and rampant sexuality. 1627. Here, unfortunately, there's a small, inexplicable lacuna in the research. 1755. Samuel Johnson includes the word tater in his dictionary. 1778. In a war between Prussians and Habsburgs, neither side is able to win the battlefield, so both try to starve out the other by stealing and eating the enemy's stockpile of potatoes. The Belgians invent French fries. 1845. Potato crop failure in Ireland. 1 million people starve to death. The Irish become famous. 1853. Out of spite for an insolent customer, half Native American, half African American chef George Crumb invents the potato chip. His creation becomes exceptionally popular, but he forgets the pack. 1871. The Idaho potato is invented in Massachusetts. 1899. During the Alaskan Klondike Gold Rush, miners discover that potatoes are high in vitamin C, and are thus worth their weight in gold. A pound of potatoes is traded for a pound of gold. 1926. Miss Laura Scudder invents the paper bag. 1944. Unwilling to take the abuse any longer, Anne Frank writes of her odium of potatoes. 1955. The first baked potato to be microwaved is microwaved by the Raytheon Corporation. 1968. The Canadians invent instant potato spuds. 1971, the International Potato Center, CIP, Lima, Peru, with the mission to help developing nations increase potato production and consumption. 1989, a small group of academics tries to reclaim the potato for itself and begin calling it the super tuber, but this never really catches on. 1994, potato consumption is on the rise in most parts of the world. China leads all nations by producing 40 million metric tons, 4 million, Poland 23, the United States 21, Ukraine 16, and India 15. Average annual per capita consumption is reported to be highest in certain highland regions of Rwanda, 153 kilograms per year. 2001. Americans eat 90% of their meals in automobiles, and each automobile weighs on average 3,900 pounds. 2006. Although the potato becomes a prime candidate for farming in outer space, the results of a nationwide poll suggest that most people believe the potato is too modest to accept. 2008. Still betting on peace after decades of multilingual discourse, the United Nations names this year as the International Year of the Potato, IYP. So I'll just read the facing one because it's about bacon. This is the one on the broadside, and this is for my friend Mike, actually, who's in the audience tonight, who was my, I first met Mike at Breadloaf over in Vermont. He was my roommate. We were both waiters at Breadloaf in 2001, when we were still, middle of August 2001, right? I was still a virgin, actually, then. Oh, it wasn't Mike, I'm sorry. Poem for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. At the annual luncheon, of course I pass up the orange pom-poms of row and reach for the BLT. Full affair, and looks and tastes real, but is probably fat-free. Lots of people mistake a rock for a bear, but almost no one mistakes a bear for a rock. There are strips and strips of bacon in malls across America. Scholars say that while he was writing Lolita, Nabokov ate hundreds of pigs in a blanket. On the mall in D.C., softball, watch fireworks, and occasionally clutch terrible placards. What about a replica of the Capitol and bacon? When I'm very hungry, I think I could eat one at an all-night, all-bacon diner. What about a flag of bacon? Oh, I would not have the courage to fly it, for who would apologize to the pigs and hogs and sky? So we were talking about typing earlier, and it made me think of Patriots. And the poem's called Patriot Acts. It's a funny little term, Patriot Act, you know. And I kept hearing it at first, I kept using the act as a verb, like what would a patriot do, you know? And I kept thinking, well, just about anything you do is patriotic, isn't it? Like doing the dishes, that'd be a nice thing to do, wouldn't it? Just patriotic, or like I don't know. Having sex or whatever, but this poem has nothing to do with having sex. Patriot Acts. Don't be embarrassed if you don't get it right the first time. The O. In making that reach, raise the J and K fingers slightly to give the L finger greater freedom. Lift the F finger slightly and type, fold your gold in an old bowling ball bag. Hold the A finger on the A key. Make the reach without twisting the elbow. The letter M is controlled by the J finger. Type, cox, mock lurk, and jerk lock. Type, I can go for them. I can go, she has gone for it. Type, he gave cash for it. Joe had the new rod in the net for her. Type, she won't have to go. Type, I can hear him sing. Type, I am going there, I am, yes. Type, I can do this right. The question mark is the shift of the last key at the right of the first row. Type, hold the hand steady as you shift and make the reach for the question mark. Type, these sentences are the work that I must write now. I must write them with ease and control. This I can do if I write just as I think I can. Type go, type gone, type you must. I'll just read a couple more. I live in New Orleans now, and this is from a series of poems called Green Zone New Orleans. And it's really for nine voices. It's for nine voices in unison. That's a little note. And there's nine parts, but there's not nine of me. So I'm just going to read a few parts of these. Green Zone New Orleans. Some people have been to New Orleans before. How about been to New Orleans after? Yeah. Did you notice a change after? No? Yeah, big parts look the same, you know. The quarter, you know, the French quarter. It's above sea level, so nothing happened there really except for some windows or something breaking. But the lake, it's a crescent city if you've never been there before. Even if you've been there before, it's kind of easy to miss this. It's sandwiched between a huge lake called Lake Pontchartrain, which is 20 miles across and farther even in width. And the Mississippi River isn't what flooded. You think so, right? It's on the Mississippi. That's what flooded. Well, that's a higher ground, right? Lake Pontchartrain flooded. So big areas of the Ninth Ward, you always hear about the Ninth Ward, but all these other areas flooded too. The University of New Orleans flooded, and Lakeview and Lake Vista, these really nouveau riche areas with like 3,000 square foot homes flooded. So people aren't back in those either, you know? It really took a toll. So it's just a ghost town in certain areas. Certain areas of the Garden District, the French Quarter. I live in uptown near the universities, Tulane, Loyola. You wouldn't know anything, you know? But other parts, you just drive another about mile and it's bizarre. It's like a neutron bomb went off. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Green Zone, New Orleans. Forgive me, home, I have to go and can't take you with. They say I can't even take a photo of you. They say don't bother to burn the master's bed, we'll provide you a new one. They say, I'm sorry, isn't what it used to be. But I will keep writing your name in the pancake batter. I will outline your body in our sheets with lipstick. It's a mess. I will no longer cry or pretend a wreck is a neat animal. I will no longer lie. Most of my thoughts are memories, and what isn't is a mirror I break my nose against. For I shall leave no inheritance but this napkin, and thus I have come into this napkin of this day. Black and pink, black and lilac, black and scarlet, black and maize, black and orange, a rich harmony, black and white, a perfect harmony, black and brown, a dull harmony, black and drab or buff, black, white, or yellow and crimson, black, orange, blue, and scarlet, black and chocolate brown, black and shaded cardinal blue and old gold, black, yellow, bronze, blood, and sky blue. Forget some call love bedside grammar. The body rules, and it's a trick of the mind not to think so. You'll never see, and nobody will ever know your mind. God exists to give your daughter someone to believe in when you're gone. On the other hand, one day she will ask you a question you don't know the answer to, because the answer is the question. Don't act nonplussed. What's the meaning of life, for example, is simply a claim to intelligence and a pledge that no other hand takes one in hers. For believe me or not, there are a finite number of ideas and a finite number of brains. Those ideas compete for space in those brains. If faith is a place circumscribed by the idea of its reign, and I can't move your heart, even with a bullet at close range, to this page, the only way I have left of touching you from here. Just read